Well, I read a fascinating book a couple years back, and in this book, a lady was doing a sociological analysis, a comparison, between two generations of American women, a grandmother and her granddaughter. And her granddaughter is about 20 years of age, and the grandmother is about 70, so about 50 years separates these two generations of women. And one of the most astounding things that I remember from the book was the author observed that in the days of the grandmother, you were pretty much free to eat whatever you wanted. But you better not sleep around. And you come 50 years later, and we now have a whole generation of people that say, it doesn't matter who you sleep with, but don't eat red meat. Don't eat chickens unless they've been free range, or don't eat them at all. And what about those caged birds and the eggs that they produce? And on it goes. And you look at that and you say, how can we come so far or flip so far in just really a relatively short period of time? Well, I think it's a situation just like Isaiah talked about back in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. And that's exactly where we've gotten in our own culture and society. Not about everything, but by a great many things. I never thought I would live long enough to see my fellow Americans arguing that, yes, I believe in the freedom of speech, as long as the speech is approved by the government. And I'm like, that's not what that means. You're taking words and phrases and turning them upside down on their head. Now, of course, that's a political observation. That's not particularly a moral precept we're concerned with. But again, I'm just astounded that in my lifetime, if you told me when I was 20 years old that I would live long enough to hear people talking that way, I would have said, no, that kind of change cannot happen that fast. And yet, we have been witness some rather dramatic changes that have taken place. Well, what's going on? Well, that's what we've come to talk about, this business of humanism. Now, if there ever was a misnomer, this is it. And it seems as if the people that hold the field of all the things that I vehemently disagree with pick all of the right words. You know, they're pro-choice. Well, what does that make me? I'm against choices now. Well, I'm pro-choice, but I can't use that phrase because it's been corrupted to mean something entirely different. And humanism. Christians are the true humanists. We are the ones that exalt the true humanity. And that's what we're trying to see restored in Jesus Christ. The only perfect human being that ever walked the planet was Jesus Christ. He showed us what it is to be truly human. Now, we have this expression, to err is human and to forgive divine. Well, that's just plain nonsense. Now, I know what we mean by it, and we're not going to change that. And yet the reality is that if it's an essential part of humanity's sin, then Jesus must have sinned because he was human. But he didn't, because that's not an essential part of humanity. Now, it's typical for most of us humans, but only because we're not being human anymore. Only because we're living in a subhuman way. And so this is the problem that we've come together to consider tonight. What really is humanism? Well, I think a better word to describe it is selfism. Because that's really what it is, the exaltation of the self. Don't be mistaken. You hear people talking about humanity. Yeah, humanity, that's okay. They're going to put it in broad terms, but what they're really thinking about is what about me? And what about my rights? And what about what I want and my feelings? Because that's really what they're most concerned about. And so what is this? Well, before we get into the lesson, let me just say thanks for the invitation to be with you. You know, I've always enjoyed coming up here and renewing some associations. I can't always remember which names go with which faces and that kind of thing. But any opportunity to share the gospel is always, of course, like saying sick 'em to a dog, you know. But I particularly am grateful that you're standing firm for the truth in this area. And that's what I'm here for tonight. I didn't come to collect Pokemons or whatever it is. I heard about that you had out in the parking lot, but that's not what we're here for. We're here to find something much more substantial and important, and that is the truth of who we are as human beings. And the Bible has a certain point of view, and this world has a different point of view. And I must say, I'm not that particularly concerned about preaching to diehard humanists, secular humanists tonight. They're never going to pick up a Bible. They're never going to give any thought to spiritual things unless something happens within them that starts telling them to listen to that little voice inside that is whispering to them, there's got to be something more. There has to be something beyond this emptiness and this meaninglessness that we experience when we pursue nothing but self and find that it does not satisfy. What I'm more concerned about are people who have enough of a biblical grounding that we talk Bible and we talk morality and we think about right and wrong, but we have still imbibed of the spirit of the age and we've still allowed the secular culture around us to influence our thinking. It's like trying to stay at home and separate yourself from the world, but the noxious fumes still creep in through the cracks, the chinks in the doors and the windows. And that's my real concern, the degree to which we can be secularized by our culture and not even realize it. Now, that is, to me, the real danger. And if we can share some things together that will help us to think in more biblical ways, less self-centered ways, then I think our time together will be well served. You've seen this before. You look at how a lot of religious groups, even some that might put a sign out front claiming that this church belongs to Jesus Christ, and yet the very appeal of trying to bring people in for the gospel is something sensual. You know, we'll feed you, or we'll give you some fun, or we're going to promise you that your life in some physical, this worldly sense is going to be so much better. Well, and people are attracted to that. But the very message of the gospel is a message of self-denial and sacrifice and suffering and even surrendering to the point of complete death in order to serve people who don't even deserve it. That's not a self-centered message. That is not self-appealing. That is not self-exalting. That is not self-indulging. And therefore, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1, is a message of madness to this world. The problem is that the presuppositions that we operate by have changed. So that's the first thing I want us to think about. The presuppositions of this secular humanism. The presuppositions of this young lady who feels no compunction whatsoever about who she sleeps with, but is very fastidious about her diet. What happened? What presuppositions is she living by that are different from her grandmother? And what we will see is those very presuppositions will lead to this situation that Paul describes in Romans chapter 1. We'll pick up in verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, that is, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And therefore God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Here Paul describes this fundamental separation. Those that look to God to define morality, who look to God to define who we are, made in the image of God, and those who look elsewhere and say, no, we will look to ourselves to define our own morality or to discover our own good or meaning or purpose in this life or whatever it is. So what are the presuppositions of this humanism? Well, first of all, humanity is all that matters. Now, they would include it within that planet Earth, of course. We got to be concerned about climate change. We got to be concerned about beached whales. We got to be concerned about, you know, spotted owls and trees. And of course, what does the Bible teach about these things? We should be good caretakers of the environment. That is a task that God has given to us. So the fact that we believe in a creator and that we believe there's more than just this world doesn't mean we're to be careless with it and we can just pollute and defile it all that we want. That's how these humanists sometimes want to paint it. So we don't care about the world. We're so stuck up in the clouds about spiritual things in heaven, we don't care about the earth. Well, that's just nonsense. The earth testifies to the glory of God. And just as we might desecrate the body of some loved one, and that shows our disrespect for them, not just their body, our disrespect for what God has created shows a disrespect for the Creator, a disrespect for God. But to them, humanity is all that matters. Now again, they're going to say, oh, we care about the environment, we care about all the little furry critters and all of that. But it's always people, isn't it? It always comes back to people. Because they even have to admit, we are the highest developed of all the animals. We are the most intelligent. We are the ones that are capable of making decisions and making plans and enacting plans that are going to save the planet. And you see that. No one is so deluded that they stand around saying, why don't the beached whales do something? When are those spotted owls going to pony up some money and stop climate change? No, it's always people, you see. Because that's all there is to them is people. And so there is no God, of course. A second presupposition is, that follows from that, there's nothing supernatural. There's no God, there's no supernatural activity of any kind. If there is no God, there's nothing to account for anything supernatural, no one to cause the supernatural. Everything that happens can be explained by simple natural cause and effect. You see some water drops coming down out of the sky. What's causing that to happen? Well, our ancestors were so superstitious and stupid, they didn't know about the water cycle and rain and all of that, and so they attributed it to the actions of some god, some sky storm god somewhere. Well, we're beyond all of that silly superstition. We have a scientific explanation of why it rains. Now, you know, there's actually a lot of things that we don't understand in the natural world. But we're so convinced that science has the answer that if we just keep looking, we'll eventually figure it out. I dare say if we had a dead person here tonight and they were resurrected, they came back from the dead, a diehard secular humanist would say, no, there's a natural explanation for that. Don't know what it is, but we need to get this guy over to a hospital or some research lab and figure out what happened. That's how determined they are to know there is no such thing as the supernatural, no such thing as miracles. In fact, they would go so far as to say the only thing that exists in reality is what you can see with your five senses, what you can sense. And so I can see it, I can hear it, I can touch it, taste it, and so on. You know, scientists can do research about it, they can conduct experiments on it in a laboratory, and all of that. That's all there is. As Carl Sagan would famously say, you know, the cosmos is all there is and all there ever will be. That's just it. There is no God. There is nothing supernatural. It all just operates by natural rules. And that tells us a third thing about humanism. Science has replaced God. We have no need for God to explain why things happen. Science will do that for us. Technology will fix all of our problems. Now, granted, we still live in an age where there are some cancers we can't cure, some other diseases that are still fatal, but with enough research money and enough smart people working together, we'll figure out those things too. I mean, you see silly headlines all the time, like human immortality just a few years away. I think the sheer arrogance of people, at least the way I see it. And so there are no sources of truth other than science to these people. They would even say there's no intelligence. There's no such thing as morality. There's no purpose in life. There is no meaning to life. Now, you're not going to hear most common people say this, but the intellectuals who've really thought through this, They realize that in the final conclusion, what they say, I am just a pile of chemicals that are biochemically interacting with one another. And at some point, they're going to start biochemically interacting with one another in a different way. And we call that death. But it's just chemicals doing their thing, and they're just doing it different now. And after death, those chemicals are going to interact in a different way, and we call that decay or decomposition. And that's just the cycle of life. That's all that there is. And there's nothing more than that, nothing transcendent. The only thing that exists is the physical and the material. And so the idea that there really is intelligence, or there really is design, or there really is morality, it looks like that, but that's just because those neurons in your brain keep firing and making you think these things, but it's not real. So, where does that leave us? Why do people like Richard Dawkins then continue to be so evangelistic about their atheism? I mean, here's a guy who writes books and books and books arguing that there is no God. Why? And especially if it's all meaningless anyhow. And he would say, well, because that's how his neurons are firing. That's what his little pile of biochemicals are doing. And he just can't help it because we're all pre-programmed biologically to do what we do. And so it looks like we're engaging in a discussion or arguing a point back and forth, but we're not really. It's just our chemicals doing their thing and interacting with one another. There is no God that will solve our problems. We're all on our own. We must look to ourselves to fix our problems, which to me is a little inconsistent, because if you really believe all of this is just biological interaction, how can you say there are any problems? You know, when the lion eats the, you know, moose, that's just what lions do. You can't say, well, the lion's being mean, or he's being violent, or we should have a trial and put him in prison for 8 years for, you know, killing that moose. You don't do that. You don't even think in moral terms when it comes to animals. And so what enables you to even say there's a problem? How can you say there is what is good and there is what is evil? There is something that is morally wrong. Well, I will argue it's because deep down we know there is. And it doesn't matter how much we deny it, it is still there. And we'll need to listen to that voice within. And finally, the last presupposition that we have seen really come to the fore in recent years is feelings are what are paramount. I mean, when you get rid of everything else, what are you left with but just your feelings? And you can see why feelings are such a compelling argument to people, because nobody can tell you your feelings are not real. You know you feel the way that you feel. And people might tell you you shouldn't feel that way, but you do. Now, what do you do about these feelings? Well, what a lot of people would say, what the humanist would say is, well, there's nothing wrong with those feelings, and you should embrace those feelings. And true freedom is found when you don't allow those feelings to bother you. And so if you feel like flying off the handle or screaming or something, as long as you don't hurt somebody else, and I don't know why that's still a rule. Why not hurt other people? That's what the lion would do to the moose. And if we're just biological organisms, but we still have certain rules, you know. You don't hurt other people. And of course, that hurt is only defined in financial and physical terms. We can, you know, emotionally hurt people, spiritually hurt people. Those things don't really count as much as the physical things. So feelings become the be-all of everything. And follow your feelings. And you'll even recognize that's advice that's given to a lot of Christians even. Well, is that what the Bible teaches? It's all about our feelings. And so those are the presuppositions that are going to undergird what's going on here. Secondly, let me talk about some of the problems with those presuppositions. First of all, I would say that the secular humanistic approach is arrogant, as I've already suggested, and rather closed-minded. I mean, you think about this person who claims to be so scientifically driven. I'm all about science, right? Well, what would a real scientist do? A scientist observes nature. He observes the cause and effect that goes on around him, and he tries to figure out what are the rules? What are the laws of nature that explain why when this happens, this is the result of that? this is the cause and this is the effect. Well, yes, scientists do that. But what we have done is we have now taken science and act as if science now determines what's going to happen. That science becomes an actual law that says this is what must happen, and you know, anyone that breaks the law, well, we've prescribed what it must be. And so we take a leap from making observations about the physical world into making philosophical conclusions about what we would call the metaphysical world. Well, when a scientist does that, like Dawkins does, he's completely left his proper domain, and he's now dealing in the area of philosophy. The area of the mind, the area of the transcendent, if there is such a thing. And so, what would a true scientist do? You know, if in his experience, in his observations, he saw something happen, and he's already made up his mind and said, well, that can't happen. And he sees it happen. What's he going to do? He's going to say, well, no, that didn't happen. I refuse to consider this as evidence that it could happen. So we're just going to completely dismiss that and move on to something else. No, you wouldn't do that. You would say, wow, this is different. Let's see if we can replicate this. Let's see if we can figure out what's happening here. And that's what a true scientist would do. But what we do in the metaphysical realm is we say, well, I've never seen anybody resurrected from the dead. Therefore, it cannot happen. And therefore, I know Jesus was not resurrected. And then they'll do silly things like David Hume's argument from back in the 18th century. Let's count up all the people that died and stayed dead. And that's billions and billions, right? And let's count up all the people that died and were resurrected. Well, there's Jesus and a couple other people you might read about in the Bible. Let's just assume for sake of argument those are true, you know. Well, you got billions and billions versus one. Well, that's just so astronomical. Couldn't happen. It's impossible to believe in such a thing. And of course, you see, that's kind of silly. It's like, you know, what are the odds of being dealt a royal flush in poker? I don't know because I don't play poker. I don't know a thing about poker. I just know it's astronomical, right? And if you were dealt a hand like that, would you say, no, I don't have a royal flush in my hand. Because that's just, the odds of that are just impossible. So it did not happen. And you're looking at the cards. Well, that'd be absurd. Talk about closing your mind, talking about refusing to look at the facts. What you would do is you'd say, this is either a really, really rare occurrence, and I'm one of those people out of so many hundreds of thousands or millions where it had to happen, or someone probably has stacked the deck. And it isn't just random odds anymore. Someone fixed it, right? Not surprising at all. Those aren't astronomical odds at all. Now, is it just random odds that Jesus came back from the dead? You know, out of billions and billions of people, there's one in a, you know, 50 billion chance some dead body's going to pop back up, and it happened to be Jesus. No. But if there is a creator, God, who resurrected Jesus from the dead, well, that's not random odds at all. And so it's kind of like, if I'm listening to my AM radio, and that's all I got, AM radio, and I dial in that AM radio to every possible station, every frequency, and I say, you know, I hear these people talking about FM radio. It just doesn't exist. I've been looking and looking and looking for any FM radio station on my AM radio, and I haven't found any. And you'd look at me like, what a pathetic person. Bless Tom's heart. He just ain't that bright. And yet we have supposedly some of the most brilliant people on the face of the planet doing this all the time. I don't see any evidence for God. My eyeballs haven't seen God. My ears haven't heard God. It'd be like a race of aliens who came to planet Earth to investigate us. And let's say this race of aliens does not have the sense of hearing. And so as they watch and observe us and smell us and all these other things they do have senses for, they notice we keep talking about this thing called hearing. And they come and observe a concert. And these people are banging away on some instruments, and periodically people seem to be putting their hands together in appreciation or something. Something's going on here. And one alien says to the other, maybe it's this thing called sound they keep talking about. And the other alien says, oh, you poor fella. There's no such thing as sound because I've never heard it. How absurd that would be. And so here we are trying to sense God with our five senses, and it's not possible because God does not live in this physical reality the way that we do. And we're just looking for him in the wrong place. It'd be like Hamlet in Shakespeare's play Hamlet. And Hamlet goes looking around saying, well, you know, I keep hearing about this Shakespeare fella. And I've looked around all over Denmark or whatever. I can't find him anywhere. He's not in the story. He's the author. He is outside of the story. He is transcendent beyond the story. And in the same way, we're not going to find God by looking for him like we are a lost puppy or some, you know, friend of ours or something that we haven't seen in a while. And so, you know, how close-minded can you be? There is no evidence for God because what evidence there is for God, we don't admit is evidence. We don't admit it into the court of law. And secondly, I would say the real big problem with this is the circular reasoning that is involved. And that stems from that. I see no evidence that the miraculous happens. Well, what about this story we have of some eyewitnesses who claim that a person who came back from the dead, well, that doesn't count because resurrections don't really happen, so we know that's just a made-up story. Oh, what about this story over here? Someone else says, oh, that's just a made-up story too. Well, what about all the evidence? What evidence? You've not given me any of it. So, well, yes, I have. Oh, that doesn't count. That's not evidence. Why? Because I've already made up my mind. People can't come back from the dead. See, that's circular reasoning. Of course you're going to find evidence that proves what you already think because you'll only look at the evidence that agrees with what you already believe. That's circular reasoning. And it results in contradictory reasoning. And so people will say, I only follow science. I will only accept as true that which science proves to be true. That sounds very noble, sounds very scientific, very rational. If you ever hear someone say that, you say to them, that's a very interesting proposition you're making. In what laboratory did scientists determine that this is the number one rule of reality, that only what science can determine is true is true? That principle was never concluded by any scientific experiment. Science did not prove that principle to be true. So I know at least one rule that you follow in life is true that science has not proven. And everybody has to have that fundamental presupposition before science can even begin to do its work. And so you see, it's contradictory. They're contradicting themselves. The same thing happens when they say there's no truth. No absolute truth. No truth with a capital T. There's just what I think is the truth and what you think is the truth and whatever's true to you, whatever's true to me, as long as we don't bother each other, that's the only truth there is. And you just ask the person, oh, is that true? Of course they believe there's an absolute truth. And for them, their absolute truth is there is no absolute truth. Well, that's contradictory. Yeah. And you'd think people that were intelligent enough to be able to talk would understand that, but they don't. It comes out in other forms. We should tolerate everything, except intolerant people. You intolerant people, we're not going to tolerate. Well, doesn't that violate your principle of tolerance you were touting so boastfully a moment ago? They don't even see the contradiction. Do you remember that Star Wars movie? Remember when Skywalker, Anakin's transforming into Darth Vader. And Obi-Wan Kenobi says to him, only the Sith speak in absolutes. The moment I heard that in the theater, I said, well, Obi-Wan, that sounds like a pretty absolute statement. Only the Sith speak in absolutes. I guess Obi-Wan's a Sith Lord now, because only the Sith speak in absolutes. How can people write stuff like this that is so inherently self-contradictory and people not think it's absurd? And yet how many people just sat in the theater like, oh wow, that's so profound. You know, and that's what happens. You know, you drink the Kool-Aid and you just listen to this stuff and you think it makes sense, but when you stop and consider it, it's like, this doesn't make any sense at all. There is no such thing as truth. Well, that's a truth statement. It's a truth claim. And the question is it true or not? And what is the evidence that we have whether it is true or not? And so another problem, a second whole category of problems I would have with the presuppositions of humanism, is the fruit that it has borne, you know, by their fruit you shall know them. You know, has this produced a better world? Has it produced a better outcome? The 20th century is certainly replete with all the horrors of what man is capable of doing to man when he exalts man and leaves God out of the picture. We see the wholesale destruction of the home happening in our own society at a rather rapid pace. Is that an improvement? And there are actually secular humanists that would say, yeah, we need to break free of the restraints of traditional, you know, Christian values. And the home is one of those things. We just need to get over it and destroy the very notion of family and of home. And if we could break free of that, we would truly be free and no longer enslaved to these silly ideas. We have people that are more confused than ever. They're confused even about whether they're male or female. They're confused about their identity. They're looking for themselves. There are higher rates of suicide and depression. Doesn't seem like there's much improvement going on. Now, I'd be the first person to admit there are a lot of people that claim to be Christians that have done some bad things. But not nearly on the scale of those that have forsaken God, and rarely because they're following the teaching of Christ. I would, in fact, say never. When people are holding true to their philosophical principles, it makes sense when communists do what communists do, when fascists do what fascists do, and on down the line. When people follow the principles of Christ, they don't commit the kind of atrocities that some have done in the name of Christ. It's always an aberration. It's always because they weren't truly following the teaching of Christ. But the question remains, when we follow the principles of self and we say there's no truth and there's no morality, there's no intelligence, and so on, then what do we expect the outcome would be? In fact, we ought to be thankful that these people are not consistent. Because in fact, they're living off of the inertia of the Judeo-Christian values the Bible teaches. They're still operating by the code of God, even if they have renounced God Himself. And I would say ultimately that the one thing we have in common that we're all trying to do is we're trying to eliminate the guilt of sin. And there are two ways you can go about doing that. You can say that sin is an offense against God. It has corrupted our image of being made in the image of God. And Christ has come to restore that image, and we can find forgiveness and the removal of sin itself, and therefore the removal of the guilt of sin. That's the Bible's answer to that question. The secular humanist says, yeah, we need to get rid of the guilt of sin, but there is no such thing as sin, really. And that bad feeling we have, we just need to get over that. And that what's causing that bad feeling are all these oppressive religious, you know, organizations and laws and rules that we've been saddled with, and if we could overthrow those, we'd no longer feel bad about all of this stuff. And the question is, who's right? You know, which process is actually going to result in the removal of the guilt of sin? And so the secular humanist says it's all about self. If we exalt self and we actualize self, and the Bible says, no, if you crucify self. We need to create our identity. Just fashion it, make it be whatever you want it to be. No, we need to discover our identity as children of God, as people made in the image of God. Self is the solution to the problem, the secular humanist says. The Bible says, no, self is the problem. It's a fundamental divide between how we approach the whole question of the self. And part of the problem is we have been deceived by science. Because technological advances have been so remarkable, and man's capacity to harness the laws of nature, we have been so successful to a great extent that we have deceived ourselves into thinking that we really have control over the entire physical universe. Now, that's not new to our age. You know, back at the beginning of the 1900s, it was, hey, we can build a ship that is so great, God Himself cannot sink it. That's what the captain of the Titanic was reputed to have said as they set off on their voyage. And I wouldn't be surprised why God would sink that ship. You take such great pride, arrogant pride in your technology. And you're still just a speck of dust in the grand scheme of things with God. You don't have the kind of control that you think you do. And yeah, we've done some amazing things in medicine, in physics, in chemistry, and so on. But you still can't tame a hurricane. Oh, but, you know, that breakthrough's just around the corner. We can make hurricanes a thing of the past. Well, good luck to you. And if man's capable of doing that, it'll be because God has blessed him with that ability to harness the natural laws. But we really cannot manipulate the physical universe as well as we think we can. But we can manipulate some things. And what this has happened is we have duped ourselves into thinking we can equally or even more so manipulate the rules of the spiritual realm. And that's the real question that we have to ask and answer. Are there spiritual laws just as surely as there are natural laws? We know just as sure as we're sitting here that if we walk up to a cliff that's 300 foot tall, if I throw myself off this cliff, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen. Don't know for sure because maybe, you know, somebody will come along in their rocket ship and save me or whatever. I'm going to plummet because there's something, the law of gravity. And you can defy the law of gravity if you want to, but not with impunity. Not without the law of gravity having its say upon what it's going to do to you. And what ancient man used to understand is, just as surely there are spiritual laws that you cannot violate with impunity. Yeah, you can break them. But something's going to happen, and it's not going to be pretty. And so do we really believe that we can manipulate the spiritual laws? That I can just be whatever I think I am? I'm an 89-year-old Japanese herb farmer. Because I feel like it. And I've got one gimpy leg. And I like to read, you know, Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, because that's just what I feel like. And so that's going to be who I am. Can we really manipulate the rules, the laws of the spiritual realm that way? The Bible says no. There are consequences. And I suspect the reason God created the physical world the way that He did is to teach us that the spiritual realm is similar. You reap what you sow. Why did God make that law operate in the natural realm? Probably because it gives us some insight into the spiritual realm as well. And so ultimately, the problem comes down to God again and the problem of sin. You think about Richard Dawkins again. He rails against God. But what God does he rail against? It's the God of the Bible. It's a God to whom we are accountable, a God who created us, a God who has authority over us. If this God turns out to be a superior being from another planet, an extraterrestrial who has better technology than we do, he'd be fine with that. But he cannot stomach the God of the Bible. So what's the real problem here? Not whether there's a God or not, but whether it's this kind of God who holds us accountable and says, this is wrong and this is right. And if that space alien came along and told Dawkins, this is wrong, you can't do this, Dawkins would probably say, nah, you don't have the right to tell me what to do. And I don't feel particularly compelled to do that. Now, if I'm convinced by your science and read some of your journals and so on, maybe I'll agree with you. But I don't feel bound morally to obey you. But this God of the Bible, that's a different problem. Got to get rid of him. And it really raises the suspicion that that's the real problem after all. And you see that, how people treat the story. You know, they read the Bible and they say, oh, God's so terrible. Look at this God. He's genocidal maniac. You know, he's just killing whole races of people and all these caricatures of the Bible, which even if it were true, which it's not, this is the God of the Bible we're talking about. And it'd be kind of like if you were, you know, watching the movie Superman and Superman goes flying off through the air and you say, oh, superheroes can't fly. This is just plain silly. Well, it's part of the story world. In this story, that's who Superman is. And it may violate our rules of physics, but not in the story, because all that's explained about how he's able to fly. And I'm not suggesting the Bible is merely a fictional story, but you know, people have read it for thousands of years and they see no contradiction between the God that the Bible presents and the things that God does in the story. And you can't have it both ways. Is the God of the Bible a real God or not? And if there's one or two things in there you don't like, that doesn't establish the point of whether He exists or not. That's just whether you like Him or not. And so we have to accept what the Bible says about God on God's terms. And realize, ultimately, we're dealing with very little information other than what God tells us. What can we know about God except what God tells us? And it really comes down to what I think of as our parking lot viewpoint of God. Let's suppose you went to Walmart and you know, you have to park way out because it's around Christmas time or something. The parking lot's just full. And you look way across the parking lot and you see somebody you know. Nice, godly Christian woman, wonderful mother, wonderful kid. And she has him in tow and she just turns around and smacks him in the face. And you're like, wow, what's Miss Bertha doing there? She just hauled off and slapped her kid and he wasn't misbehaving. It didn't look like he was mouthing off at her or anything. Why would she do this terrible thing? And yet, had you been right next to her and seen that this child had some poisonous insect on his cheek, that if it stung him or bit him, this child would have an allergic reaction and die. And the mother herself suffers from the same allergy. And she risks her own life to protect her child by smacking him on the cheek to kill that insect. What would you say then? Oh, what a wonderful mother. Sacrificial love. What a beautiful thing to see. See, the woman goes from being a child abuser to a hero in a matter of seconds. And the only difference is how far across the parking lot you were. And here we are, way across the parking lot, trying to pass judgment on God. And we don't have nearly all the information. And ultimately it boils down to, do you trust that woman when she came out with her son? Do you know her character? What kind of mother she is? You may not know exactly what happened, but your conclusion about what happened far across the parking lot is going to be based on, what do I know about her? And if I know her to be a godly mother, she had some good reason for what she did. I don't know what it is, but I'm pretty sure she had a good reason. But if you don't trust her, if it's just some stranger, oh, what a terrible mother. And that's our problem. Do we trust God or not? And on what basis can we trust God ultimately? And so, finally, the last little bit here, I want to talk about the proofs that we have of who's right. The presuppositions of the secular humanists, yeah, they have a lot of problems to them. That doesn't mean they're necessarily wrong. How do we know that the alternative Christian point of view of true humanism, man made in the image of God, marring that image through sin, but recreated in Jesus Christ. How do we know that's the way it is? Well, I could say, first of all, the Bible teaches that. That's not going to be particularly compelling to a secular humanist. I would say, furthermore, that Jesus Christ demonstrates that. Now, we could spend some time talking about whether Jesus Christ really was a historical person, that He was who He claimed to be. He was vindicated by virtue of His resurrection. And I think ultimately the argument from evidences hinges upon the resurrection. If the resurrection didn't happen, nothing else really matters. But if it did happen, like He said it was going to happen, and it did happen, then it vindicates Him in His claims and what He said and who He was. And what did He say the ultimate values were of the kingdom of God? Well, you can look in Mark chapter 10, where Jesus has to instruct His disciples in this. And if you just think as a thought exercise who Jesus is, and I tell this to my students all the time, if you want to analyze a religion, you analyze what problem does it purport to solve. So if our real problem in life is bad plumbing, then obviously the solution is we need better plumbing. And God should send us a great plumber. And if our problem is technology in some way, then technology is the answer. Better technology, God should send us a scientist. If it's political systems that are our problem, then we need a statesman, some expert in politics to fix our problem. You can see on and on it goes. Well, what is our real problem according to the Bible? It's sin. or self. And so the solution is the denial of self. And so what does Jesus say? And what did God send us but a servant, a sacrificial suffering servant, even when we didn't deserve it? So Mark chapter 10, verse 42, Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all." You can just imagine how offensive that is to this doctrine of self. The answer is not found in self. You must make yourself a slave of others, a servant of others, to deny yourself the role of being Lord and the slave master. "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give His life as a ransom for many." And again, how many Christians have bought into this worldly notion, "I'm here to be served"? You know, new school year is beginning down at the college. And the sad reality is, many of my generation, the parents, have raised these young people and even indoctrinated them and taught them that this is a wonderful, marvelous Christian question to ask. Go church shopping and find yourself a congregation that's going to do something for you. Show up at a church and say, "What are you going to do for me? What program do you have? What do you got to offer me? I'm here to be served, folks! Get busy!" And we have taught them that this is true to the gospel. We have taught them that this is actually the mind of Christ. It's just another version of self. And if we're going to go that direction, it doesn't matter whether we're going to church or whether we claim to be Christian. We've just drunk whole hog the Kool-Aid of this world. It's all about me and my feelings and what I want. And what did Jesus say? "I'm here to serve. I'm here to be a servant. I'm here to be a slave. I'm here to crucify self and follow Jesus, the perfect and ultimate slave that showed us the way." And when you look at the history of mankind, you will see that these Judeo-Christian values are what have really led to the true advances that have taken place in civilization. The cultures that were stagnant for centuries were prompted to change because of Judeo-Christian values, like science. We worship science so much in this day and age, but where did science come from? Why did the world suddenly pull itself up out of all of the superstition and the voodoo and all of that to pursue a scientific way of life? Because they were convinced there was a creator who had designed the creation and there was an orderly system to the laws of nature that could be observed and replicated. There would be no science had it not been for that, or at least science as we understand it. And even the social developments that have happened, you know, the early 1800s, when slavery was abolished by the British. And they didn't do that because it was practical, because it was economical, but there was no benefit whatsoever, almost, in fact, bankrupted the British Empire. But they did it merely because they thought it was the right thing to do. What principle of Darwinian evolution would teach us that you should not enslave other people? In fact, if you can, why not? What principle of Darwinian evolution would teach us that women and men are equal? Obviously, that's one of the great mantras of our age. And they are, because the Bible teaches that. But Darwinian evolution, you'd never get there. There's no reason to think that this race is not superior to that race. And this gender is not superior to that gender. Why are they equal? Because the Bible says that we are all made in the image of God. And yes, these secular humanists, they're not bad people. They're not just slaughtering people by wholesale genocide. But it's only because they're still holding on to the core of these Judeo-Christian values. If they were true to their philosophy, they would be morally and spiritually bankrupt. But finally, again, I would say to you, it's that inner voice that we need to listen to. And if I had more time, I'd spend some more time talking about this. That's just my way of saying you got to have me come back. But I'll tell you one story along this line. You know, my mother passed away, and my oldest brother, he's a professor in chemistry at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. and long ago left the Lord, has no use for God, has swallowed hook, line, and sinker all of the presuppositions of secular humanism. And so as we gather for the funeral of my mother, ultimately what it boiled down to is there's just a pile of biochemicals there, and I'm just a pile of biochemicals. And when that pile of biochemicals was functioning in a different fashion, then my pile of biochemicals was functioning in a different fashion in something that I would call love and pleasure that I took in communicating with this other pile of biochemicals and all of that. And then suddenly, because that pile of biochemicals started operating in a different way with themselves, then my pile of biochemicals started feeling differently in what we call an emotion that we call grief. But it's nothing but chemicals interacting with one another. And when you're standing there at the casket side of a loved one, you just have to say, really? When you think of all that life has to offer and what there is, that there is nothing more than this. Does not the experience of human love teach us that there's something transcendent, there's something beyond? There are hints to this transcendency all around us. We could spend time talking about the sexual relationship. We don't talk about that much in churches, unfortunately, because that's probably the most powerful sensation and feeling that this world has just given itself over to as an idol, because it is so powerful. But it is also for that very reason the thing that proves that they're mistaken. And so you see the inconsistency by which we operate. If we're really just animals, we don't seem to act like animals when it comes to our sexual relationship. Now, I know some people seem to act like animals, but there's nothing about the physicality of our bodies that would determine how many partners we have, or whether they're children or adults, or whether they're members of our own family, or whether members of our own species, and on it goes. None of those things would matter. And yet every culture down through the ages has had taboos about these things. And we still hold to them, even though we throw many of them away and say, well, it doesn't matter. You can engage in this with people of the same gender and all this. We still have rules, don't we? And number one is, must be consensual, right? And the question you have to ask is, why? Why does it have to be consensual? There is no reason it has to be consensual. Given your presuppositions, where does this rule of consensual relationship come from? Where does any moral impulse come from? Because there's something deeper within us. There's something more than just the physical. There is something transcendent, something beyond just this body. We are more than this body. And that's what the Bible teaches us. And a lot more could be said about that, but we'll have to leave it there for tonight. And to come back to the biblical principle, which is we're made in the image of God. And that means we were made for relationship. That means we were made to serve others and not to be served. And that we are to love them and serve them. And we get practice doing that in a spiritual family, like a local congregation. And we get practice doing that in our physical families as well. And so at this time, we're going to sing a song of invitation. As we think about our relationship with the Lord, we should think about how well are we following in the footsteps of Jesus. Is the answer really myself? And my feelings, and indulging myself and exalting myself? Or is the answer truly found in being like Jesus? Deny self, take up our cross, and crucify self daily, and then follow Jesus in a life of sacrifice and suffering and serving people, even when they don't deserve it. There's some way we may have helped anyone tonight. This is a good time to let that be known while we stand and sing the song.